You're listening to HuntertonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located in the CenturyLink building at 14 Mine Street, Flemington, New Jersey. The content and views of our hosts do not necessarily reflect the views of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. To contact our station, call 908-782-7115 or email onair@hunterdon-chamber.org. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programming.
Insurance will cover personal property loss or damage as well as provide liability protection. Visit geico.com today.
The U.S. is going to keep more troops in Afghanistan than planned, AP correspondent Carlotta Bradley reports.
The Obama administration is abandoning plans to cut the number of U.S. forces in Afghanistan to 5,500 by the end of the year. Military leaders want to keep more troops there. While no final decision on numbers has been made, officials say the administration is poised to slow withdrawal plans and probably will allow many of the 9,800 American troops to stay well into next year. There are also discussions about keeping a steady number of counterterrorism troops into 2015, including options under which some would stay in the country or be nearby beyond 2016. Carlotta Bradley, Washington.
The Syrian president says only Syrians can decide their future, a statement that appeared to dismiss U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's remark that he would be willing to talk with Bashar Assad to help broker a political resolution to the country's civil war. Damascus has accused Washington of militarizing the conflict. Vanuatu's president says some 90% of the buildings in the capital sit damaged or destroyed by Cyclone Pam. At least six people are dead after the storm hit the Pacific Island nation. The death toll is expected to rise once communications are restored. China has overtaken Germany to become the world's third biggest arms exporter. A report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute says China's share of the global arms market rose 143% from 2010 to 2014. I'm Kelly Sloan, and you're listening to USA Radio News.
The news is sponsored by Patton Heide & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc.
Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they'll live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their own terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heide & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. They are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within your reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heide & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you achieve your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. That's 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Ameriprise Financial Services, Incorporated, member FINRA and SIPC.
The weather this afternoon is partly sunny with a high near 53, as west winds around 6 miles per hour. Tonight, scattered showers, mainly after 3 a.m., mostly cloudy with a low around 40. West winds around 6 miles per hour, becoming calm in the evening. Chance of precipitation is 30%, and new precipitation amounts of less than a tenth of an inch is possible. Tuesday, showers likely, mainly before noon. Cloudy, then gradually becoming mostly sunny with a high near 53. Light and variable winds, becoming northwest 12 to 17 miles per hour in the morning. The chance of precipitation is 60%, and new precipitation amounts of less than a tenth of an inch is possible. Tuesday night will be mostly clear with a low around 25, northwest winds 11 to 16 miles an hour. Wednesday, mostly sunny with a high near 39, northwest winds 13 to 18 miles per hour with gusts as high as 30 miles an hour. Wednesday night will be mostly clear with a low around 23. Welcome to Mental Health Matters. I'm Larry Cartwright, your host, and this is NAMI's Hour, compliments of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and there is a chapter of NAMI in every county in the state of New Jersey, every state in the union, and overseas. In Hunterdon County, we are all volunteers. We work out of our houses. We have no paid staff, no office. We use our own equipment, our own computers, our own phones, etc. We try to help people who may have someone in their family who has a mental health issue, or someone who has a mental health issue, to get on and get through with their lives. We do this with various things. We have support groups. We teach classes. We have a 12-week family-to-family class for families who have someone in their family or a friend who they're close with who has mental health issues. We have what they call a basics class. It's for families who have little children up to age 17, I believe, who have mental health issues. And we have Hispanic classes, etc. And everything that we do, whether it's the local chapter in Hunterdon County or any county in the state or the state of New Jersey's NAMI, is free. It's totally free of charge. With that, I want to say I'm very happy today to have two wonderful guests, Robin Marks, who is the community outreach person at Princeton House, and Dr. Michael Bizzaro, who is a PhD and a licensed clinical social worker and is the director of the First Responder Treatment Services at Princeton House. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Larry. Good to see you.
It's good to see you.
It's good to be here.
Robin, I want to start with you.
Okay.
I would just like, you know, many people know what Princeton House is, but a lot of people may not. So if you could tell us what the mission of Princeton House is, who it services, and how it got started, et cetera.
Absolutely. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. Princeton House is Princeton House Behavioral Health. So we have different levels of treatment available to people. We have in Princeton a 110-bed psychiatric facility that people come and stay overnight for stabilization. Then we have five outpatient services, because once you're stable in a hospital, it's just like any illness. You need some sort of treatment afterwards. So we titrate them down to a PHP, or that's really a partial hospitalization program. So people can come during the day from 9 to 3 and then go home in the evening. So you still have somebody monitoring them. We have nurses and doctors in all of our programs throughout all the levels, just to make sure that you know, they're stable enough. And then from there you graduate to an IOP, or intensive outpatient level. And that's usually about 3 days a week, 3 hours a week. Just again, you know, just to kind of make sure everything's going smoothly. We then have many specialty programs. We do psych, addiction, dual meaning psychiatric and chemical dependency. We have men's trauma. We have women's programming, which goes from everything from emotional wellness to women's trauma and addiction. We're one of the premier women's treatment facilities in the whole state. Just so that you can get in contact with us, if you have any questions about the inpatient program, that number is 1-800-242-2550, or any of the outpatient programs that are in Princeton, Hamilton, North Brunswick, Moorestown, and soon to be open, Tinton Falls, is 888-437-1610.
I'm going to ask you to give those later on again, because, you know, people might still be writing. You know?
Why, thank you.
But, yeah, I will have you do them again. If not, remind me. I have a short memory span. So, Dr. Bizzaro, I understand that you are the director for First Responders Treatment and so on and so forth. Now, I know a lot of people probably know what a first responder is, but maybe you could clarify who falls in that category. Because some people may be a little blurred as to what a first responder actually is, or who it is.
Sure. I guess the easiest definition would probably be anyone who runs towards an event, a traumatic event, is usually identified as a first responder. The categories that we treat at Princeton are your law enforcement, which includes your police and correction officers, EMS, EMT, firefighters, and military veterans that have been in combat situations.
All right. Active military or discharged military?
Typically discharged military.
Right, because if they're active, they probably, you know.
Who often take on positions in police or fire.
Absolutely. Right. How did you get involved in this type of thing? Well, this type of treatment, I mean, you know.
Well, in the early part of my career, in the early 1970s, I was a police officer for approximately 5 years, and also served 6 years in the military, U.S. Reserves, Army Reserves. And it's ironic how things come sometimes full circle. You know, I left the police department, and here 20-plus years later, I found myself involved in the aftermath of a governor's task force that was put together to identify the increased suicide rate among law enforcement in New Jersey, which has become a real focal point of mental health services. So as a result of that task force and a few colleagues that I work with, Cherie Castellano, who is in charge of Cop to Cop,
mm-hmm.
and Dr. Eugene Stefanelli.
In fact, she's going to be on a show next week.
Okay. Well, I do a lot of work with Cherie. And Dr. Eugene Stefanelli, who works for the New Jersey State PBA, and also Kenny Burkert, who's their peer assistance response coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
We've put together a program that has basically given all first responders in the state of New Jersey an opportunity to access services.
Okay.
So I'm not sure if I answered that question, but we also found that in New Jersey, there was no real program that provided services, inpatient services or outpatient services for first responders.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a meeting with the president. At the time, Richard Wall was the vice president. He's
right.
Now the president. We had a meeting with his staff, and we basically proposed a program to his staff back in January of 2013. And I'm happy to say that it's now 2 years later, and we've serviced almost 300 first responders today.
That's awesome. That really is.
Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, first of all, I lost my train of thought. I'm getting older. First of all, I think that it's the statistic, and I'm not big on statistics because I think you can make statistics say whatever you'd like them to say, but the statistics for suicide between veterans and police officers is higher than any other group of people.
Correct.
And that's across the country, not just in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about it, you can understand why. You know, you have to suffer somewhat of a post-traumatic stress disorder from seeing some of the things that police officers been through on a daily basis. We were talking prior, and I was saying that I worked in New York, and I knew probably 15 different police officers from various precincts in the city of New York. And we would talk, and to listen to them, it was just what they go through is just mind-boggling. In scenic Hunterdon County, they have it. Yes, they have, you know, problems. But it's nothing like Brooklyn or Manhattan or the Bronx or, you know, what have you. What I think is pretty awesome is that you're speaking from personal experience, okay? You're a veteran. You're an ex-police officer. So when you're talking to a police officer, you're talking as someone who has been there. You know, it's one thing for me to talk to a police officer and explain, oh, yeah, you should do this, you should do that, you should do the other. But I have never been a police officer. I have been in the military. I've been in Vietnam, the whole nine yards. But I haven't been a police officer. So for me to talk to a police officer, it's like they'll go, yeah, right. You know.
And just the nature of police work is such that any police officer will tell you that over the course of their career, they don't start out this way, but everybody becomes a potential suspect.
Right.
Everybody becomes a potential threat because you never know what's around the next corner. And so it's very difficult for them to, the idea of sitting down and having a conversation about how they're feeling or what's going on in their life, if you don't know what it's like to have been in their shoes, it becomes very difficult right. for them to even engage that conversation.
Right, exactly. Pardon me. Real quickly, a woman called me up and she said her son just came back from Iraq and he won't get out of his bedroom. He'll stay in bed. He won't talk to her. You know. And she says, I don't know. I try to talk to him. He won't talk to me, yada, yada. And I says, well, will he come to the phone and talk to me? She said, well, why would he talk to you? I says, well, I'm a veteran. Maybe it'd be easier if he talks to somebody who, true, I haven't been in Iraq, but it was darn close, you know, if not worse, I don't know. But, you know, so anyway, he got on the phone with me, and we talked for almost 2 hours on the phone. And I finally convinced him to attempt to go to Lyons Hospital, and he did go to Lyons Hospital, and he's still going for treatment up there, which is fine. You know, I think that's great. But I know what you're saying, you know. Why do you feel that first responder, first responders are more likely to experience substance abuse and alcoholism problems?
Well, I think, first of all, let me just say that the issue with substance abuse and alcohol in the general population is pretty serious to begin
right.
with. The nature of police work or first responder work is such that the exposure to the horror and the traumatic events that they experience on a regular basis absolutely takes a toll on an individual. The nature of their work is such that they're not one to communicate about what's going on or what just happened. They don't have the luxury, as many people do, if they respond to a horrific scene, to let their emotions take over. They have to take control of the situation. So they're always in a mindset of having to be in control, never allowing the emotions of that particular event to even creep in. Over time, it's going to take a toll on any individual. But by mm-hmm. the nature of what they do for a living, they're not afforded that luxury, because what may happen today could happen tomorrow, could happen an hour from now.
Well, yeah, that could be, that's very, you know, very true for policemen and firefighters. What about EMTs or what's the other? EMTs,
ET, EMS.
ECMS. Yeah, okay. All these acronyms drive me nuts. But
medical first responders.
Yeah, right. Medical first responders and firefighters. I mean, I understand police and veterans, because they can be shot at and, you know, go into combat situations and so on and so forth. But what about, you know, first responders who are medical personnel and firefighters?
Well, the one thing about post-traumatic stress or acute stress disorders, it doesn't discriminate. So firefighters, EMS, EMT are also exposed to the same trauma and horror that police and law enforcement are. The difference is that more often than not, when a police officer is responding to a traumatic event, there might be a person on the other end of that event that might be wanting to take their life. So it creates a totally different dynamic, the same with our military, who are always in a state of heightened vigilance. To get back to your original question about substance abuse and why is it that mm-hmm. alcohol and substance abuse is become a major issue in that profession is, anyone who knows about law enforcement knows that it's quite often that after a shift, many of the officers would get together at a local bar or tavern, and they would actually debrief what just occurred the night before. And that was actually their way of kind of talking about what just happened. Well, over time, consequently, what happens is not only do you have a problem not talking about your emotions, but now you have an alcohol problem. And so alcohol, in very early stages, works. Half this country uses mm-hmm. alcohol as a social lubricant. So in moderation, it's never a problem. But unfortunately, what happens right. is it becomes something you depend on. And quite often, injuries on duty require prescription medication, which we're finding more so today is becoming a major problem among first responders, is being prescribed pain medication. And unfortunately, it works.
Right.
It kind of has a way of alleviating all kind of pain, including emotional pain.
Mm-hmm.
It can become very, very easily abused. So those are part of the reasons why that there's been a spike in the abuse of alcohol and prescription drugs. Plus, the other thing is most law enforcement or first responders are not going to talk about what went on and what they're experiencing internally. They may describe an event, but you're very seldom going to have them describe what their emotional response was to that event.
Right.
So consequently, they keep it in.
And, you know, a lot of times people with mental health issues will turn to alcohol and drugs, and we call it self-medicating. You know, a lot of times the pain from the mental illness is so great that they'd rather lose it in alcohol or drugs, you know, and it also reverts to cutting. You know, people cut themselves because the pain in their head is, you know, so bad they want to have some other pain, you know.
We find a lot of emotional numbing in first responders. They just detach and disconnect from the event so that the emotional response is, it's kind of like almost behind a closed door in the mind where they won't allow themselves to feel or experience it for fear that once that gets in, they won't be able to control themselves.
All right. This may be a a non-professional question, but let's say someone, either some first responder, it doesn't matter what branch they are, what happens to them to make them reach out to you? In other words, most people won't reach out.
Right.
And that includes firefighters and veterans and, you know, what?
You're absolutely right. I think this particular category of occupations find it very difficult to seek help because the nature of what they do for a living is they provide assistance and help to the public. So for them to need help, it's very foreign to them. It's almost as if there's something wrong if they need help. So typically, unfortunately, what happens is there's consequences of what they do for a living. And some of those consequences turn into alcoholism, drug addiction, depression, anxiety. There's high incidence rates of domestic violence among first responder community. Typically what happens is there's a major problem either at work or at home that typically will facilitate access to either a PBA delegate, a delegate in the FMBA, which is the Fraternal Firefighters Union that oversees the firefighters. And then typically we would get involved in we would get a phone call saying that an officer or a member is in need of assistance.
Okay. One of my questions would be that responders take out their frustrations on...
That's the call for all first responders.
You know, they how often do you find that they take out their frustrations, for lack of a better word, on families? And if so, how do they do that?
Well, it's hard to quantify that. Typically what happens is it typically occurs incrementally and over time. The consequence of the secondary dangers is not something that happens immediately. As I said, it's something that occurs over time. It could manifest itself in isolation, being disconnected from the family, not participating in family-related activities. The nature of their schedules and their rotating shifts are such that more often than not, you'll find a family member, a spouse, feels like they're a single parent a lot of the time. Their weekends sometimes fall in the middle of the week.
Right.
Christenings happen on weekdays. Weddings happen on days other than the general public would have. So they really have to navigate and negotiate a relationship that's very specific and sensitive to their schedules, which becomes problematic at times.
You know, ironically, people have asked me how my wife and I have stayed married for so many years. And I said, I used to work nights and she worked days, you know. And we communicate by little stickies on the telephone, on the refrigerator, you know.
And some marriages work well like that.
Yeah, well, we've been together 50 years, so, you know.
You're doing something right.
Well, yeah, I worked nights, she worked days. No, I did have day jobs also, but, yeah. I would advise not touching it.
Yeah.
For those of you that wonder what we're laughing about, the microphone just flew up to the ceiling. You know, but you know, it just seems that. Do you? I know it's no statistical, you know, report or anything, but in your experience, do you find divorces higher among first responders than, you know?
What I can say to you is that I'm familiar with the divorce rate among the general public, which is about 50%. I would venture to say, based on that small sample that I deal with, that divorce is probably higher among the first responder community. I can also say that domestic violence is something that's very common among first responders. Mm. And people may ask, why is that? Well, you're repressing and suppressing a lot of your emotions. And, you know, as men, and I hate to generalize this and make it gender specific, but men often have difficulty expressing their emotions. And anger has been an acceptable emotion for men to express. So, unfortunately, it's not so much the emotion, it's the manner in which it's expressed that becomes problematic for men.
Right, right.
And being in control, that need for control,
right,
is so paramount. I mean, just think in terms of responding to a situation or a scene that is out of control. Your goal is to bring control into that situation so that you can resolve it as quickly as possible.
Right, right. And, you know, the thing is, too, that over the last, I don't know, maybe 15 years, there's been more women going into these various positions of first responders, military, police officers, firefighters, EMS, you know, et cetera. And, yeah, like you said, though, that men, you know, use anger, you know. What do women use?
Well,
and I'm sure you have
a question.
Yeah,
it's a good question. I think it's a blessing that more females are coming into the first responder.
Oh, I do too. I think absolutely sure.
And I think they're finding the same struggles and challenges that males are. It does, as I said, it doesn't discriminate.
Oh no,
you know,
no.
We can say, you know, women are more apt to verbalize and talk about their feelings. And I think that may be true for a lot. I don't think we can make a definitive statement
about
all women. But regardless of whether you're one that speaks about your emotions easily, when you're faced with chronic horror and trauma, you know, talk about correction officers, female correction officers that work behind the walls. 90% of the public has no clue of the challenges that correction officers face on a daily basis. Within that square mile or whatever the confines are, what goes on in there is can be frightening if it was ever put on TV. And so on a constant basis, they're exposed to and having to deal with undesirables on a regular basis.
Right.
So it takes a toll. And all of a sudden, when you get out of work, you're supposed to flip a switch and go home and take care of your children and be in a relationship that's loving and caring when you just spent 12 hours not allowing any of your emotions to surface.
And that's what I was going to say, that, you know.
4 years.
Right, yeah. Right. And, you know, women also, you know, if they're in a marriage or a relationship, they probably have kids and, you know, so they're coming home from a situation and now they got to deal with the kids. They don't want to, you know, they don't want to expose the kids to the situation that they went through. So, you know. And if their husband is not in a responder of any type, or he's an accountant or whatever, you know.
Becomes challenging.
It becomes challenging. Right. Exactly.
And that switch I talk about, or that transition over time, that switch doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because you're really on call 24/7. So
right.
When you're a police officer 24/7, whether you're in uniform or out of uniform. So that switch where you kind of leave the department and then go home and become the father and the husband and the son and the friend over time kind of doesn't work.
Yeah, I understand that perfectly. We're going to have to take a quick break. You're listening to Mental Health Matters. I'm very privileged today to have with us Robin Marks from Community Outreach at Princeton House and Dr. Michael Bizzaro, who's in charge of, is the director of the First Responder Treatment Services at Princeton House. I have a list of questions I want to ask, so we have to take a quick break, and we will be back. Stay tuned.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
Rab Coins of Flemington, New Jersey has been in business for over 37 years. We are highly competitive buyers of gold, silver, and platinum coins, jewelry, and scrap metals, and have recently been named the exclusive gold buyer for Diamond Nation and HealthQuest. We also provide professional appraisal, sales, and liquidation services for individuals, law firms, estate trustees, and bank trust departments in New Jersey and Philadelphia. Products and services include gold and silver, American and foreign coins, certified rare date and modern coins, numismatic supplies and books, gold, silver, and platinum bullion, paper currency, United States proof, and mint sets, including current issues. From junior collector to the experienced investor, Rab Coins has been for numismatists since 1974. Founder and owner, Randy Block, an expert numismatist, has been an active member of the coin industry for over 45 years. Visit us at 56 Main Street in historic downtown Flemington or call toll-free 1-800-819-9875.
Hi, this is Ruth Ann Disatel, celebrant officiant with Celebration of a Lifetime. When people ask me why I joined the Chamber, it's because I want to get to know you and what you're all about. And I want you to get to know me and what I'm all about. And together, I'd like to celebrate what we can do for Hunterdon County.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Welcome back to Mental Health Matters. I'm Larry Cartwright, your host, and our guests are Robin Marks, Community Outreach at Princeton House, and Dr. Michael Bizzaro, who is the Director of First Responders Treatment Services at Princeton House. And I have a couple questions. I have a list. But anyway, do you find that the problems are as severe or as big with volunteer first responders? Because Hunterdon County, for example, has volunteer EMS, volunteer firefighters. There's a lot of times it's the state police and not the local police because townships don't have local police in many areas. So a lot of the responders are volunteers who either have another job or whatever. Do you find that that's lesser of a problem or just as much of a problem or more of a problem? Or
it's a problem. It doesn't, as I indicated earlier, you know, mental health disorders don't discriminate, you know.
Oh no, I know that.
Yeah. Chronic exposure to trauma, whether you're a volunteer or whether you're a paid firefighter, at some point untreated there's a consequence, and far too often that consequence becomes either, you know, a divorce, a domestic violence, depression, anxiety, substance abuse. So it's really, I think when you really look for the those first responders that show some degree of resilience, it's the manner in which they handle trauma the burden of life's tragedies. Not everyone that's exposed to these traumatic events or horrific events wind up, with an alcohol or a drug problem or institutionalized. So I don't want to, communicate.
No, of course not. Right.
We're talking about a percentage of first responders who, for some reason, whether it's genetically predisposed or whatever the case may be, find it very difficult to be able to process the trauma and horror that they see.
Right. Well, it's like a lot of veterans who came back from the Second World War. My father, for example, would not talk about it. He went on with his life and everything, but he wouldn't talk about it.
My father as well.
I don't talk about what people say. Were you over? Yeah, I was there. Okay. That's enough. Change the subject,
One of the reasons that people are reluctant to talk about it is what happens when you bring up the subject. The next thing you know, I use the example of that door in the basement or the cellar door. The minute you start to discuss what you saw, what you did, what you were involved in, that door kind of opens up a little bit. And all of a sudden, the memories, the flashing, the feelings start to come in and can be very overwhelming.
Right. And also, I don't want to say everyone because it hasn't been everyone, but a large percentage of people ask totally insensitive questions. Oh, did you kill anybody?
Well, think about that question, Larry. Think about that question.
I want to kill you for asking the question,
Actually, that's the curiosity. Remember.
Oh, yeah, I understand, but it's like, it's like asking a police officer, you shoot anybody, in the last 2 years? Yeah. I mean,
You don't ever want to be faced with the situation where you have to take your weapon out and take another life.
Absolutely.
And although you train.
Exactly.
Religiously for that, you don't ever wish that event presents itself.
Right. But.
But the public's very curious, the one thing, the major difference is they can turn, if they see something on TV that is upsetting, they can turn a channel.
Right.
First responders can't. They can't turn that channel or shut it off.
No, exactly. It's there. Right, exactly. You had mentioned in some emails back and forth about the secondary dangers the first responders experience as a direct result of the primary danger they have to work with and they have in their work. Would you elaborate a little bit about that?
Yes.
Because I'm a little confused as to what that is.
Your primary dangers are the day-to-day dangers that first responders face in the course of their work. Firefighters facing their specific challenges that they face, police, military, etc. Those are your primary dangers that are associated with the occupation you chose. The secondary dangers, or the consequence of your primary dangers, are those issues that present themselves that are untreated. For instance, the increase in alcohol use, depression, anxiety, these untreated mental health disorders, financial unmanageability. What we find is that often, many first responders, in order to deal with their emotions, wind up engaging in behaviors that bring them instant relief or distract them from the unpleasant emotions that might be going on within themselves that they're reluctant to talk about. So they'll put themselves in situations, high-risk situations. They'll buy a lot of expensive, often we refer to them as toys, trucks, motorcycles.
Right.
Wave runners, RTVs, ATVs, anything that can get them out of themselves, that kind of give them that adrenaline. Remember, part of the attraction of that job is the adrenaline.
Adrenaline, right.
Well, what happens is over time, you can't shut the switch off for that adrenaline.
No.
So those are some of the secondary dangers: domestic violence, divorce, high rates of divorce, severe and serious anger issues. Sleep problems are a major problem among first responders, because of the shift work, the nature of the work they do, the memories that they have that they're unable to stop from manifesting themselves in their mind. So these are just some, and they're pretty serious, quite honestly, that can cause some major problems for them. Those are your secondary dangers. Untreated or unresolved, they wind up either leading to suicide or some serious problem where we eventually will get involved and they wind up needing to be hospitalized for drugs and alcohol or for psychiatric services. Right.
What are some of the consequences that law enforcement officers face if they seek treatment?
You know, that's a great question, and that is probably one of the most pronounced barriers for law enforcement to seek treatment. Historically, if an officer was to come inside his building and say, I'm feeling depressed, I'm having a really bad day, I'm not sleeping, chances are administration is not going to perceive that well, and they're going to send this officer for what we call a fitness for duty. They're more concerned, unfortunately, and I'm not going to say all, but many, far too many administrators in New Jersey are concerned with liability issues than concerned about what an officer may need. So officers are not apt to come forward and ask for help when they know there's a consequence on the other end of it, that they may be out of work, that they may be on administrative leave, that far too often their weapon is taken from them. They're put inside the building. They're on desk duty or they're in a radio room. They're in a non-policing function, more punitive. Right. So it's not encouraged, let's put it that way. And then among your peers start to wonder, if I'm in a situation where I need a backup. Are you going to be there for me?
Right.
So it presents many challenges for that person who might be suffering from
it. It's a stigmatism attached
absolutely.
To it. You know.
Absolutely.
You know.
And we've worked really hard at reducing that stigma by like I said earlier, the peer assistance response team that we're putting together in New Jersey, where each department has a PBA president and delegate. There's over, like, I think 400.
Right.
Well, we've trained quite a few of them. And next week you're going to be talking to Cherie Castellano, who kind of spearheaded that. So she'll fill you in a little bit more about that. But because of that training, we've now have peers in many of the local police departments that are first frontline access to services. So if one of those peer assistance response members sees an officer or signs that suggest an officer might be in trouble, they're more apt to approach them early and try to get them help rather than wait until the consequences are greater.
Is that also in like firefighters and veterans groups and stuff like that also, or just more mainly law enforcement?
It's been primarily in law enforcement.
Okay.
However, you raise a very interesting point. We are currently in the process of developing that same system among our firefighters in New Jersey. As far as I know, the VA does not have a system like that in play at this particular point in time. I'm not sure how they're outreaching their military vets that are coming back. I do know that there's a tremendous increase in funding for veterans that are returning home.
Yeah, it's... You know, it's just so sad that we need all these governmental laws and stuff to put some of these things into effect. And, you know, like the outcome of a situation has to be so drastic before people react and do something about it. And that's why I think this is so good that you guys are doing this.
The sad part is that our police and firefighters are under political attack in New Jersey. And look, this is not a political show, nor am I going to profess my political position, but clearly it's a profession that, when I grew up, police officers and firefighters were respected.
Right.
I remember from a very young age, my parents saying to me that if you ever need help, you make sure you go to a police officer.
Right.
And also, on top of that message, my dad often said to me, you better make sure a police officer doesn't bring you home either.
Oh, yeah.
So the culture has changed dramatically. You know, I continue to see this as a profession of honor and integrity, you know.
Right.
Most people are not going to do this. It takes a very select few.
That's right.
Willing to put their lives on the line to make you and I feel safe
right
at night.
And it's the same thing with a vet, you know, who career
Absolutely.
Military.
And
you
I
know.
Speak when I speak in terms of, you know, first responders, I'm specifically right. speaking to, you know, our veterans that are making sure that we're safe at home.
Exactly. But
could you imagine if we didn't have first responders, what this world would be, what our country would be like if there were no police, no corrections, no firefighters, and no military.
Right.
And yet, often, we don't treat them with that kind of respect.
No, absolutely not. I agree wholeheartedly. How will someone know when it's time to seek help?
More often than not, I hate to say this, but it's typically another person who recognizes something, some of the signs in an individual that might say to them, hey, how are you? What's going on? Are you okay? Is everything okay at home? More often than not, the person on the other end of that is probably going to say, I'm fine and everything is okay. If this was easy, Larry, you and I probably wouldn't be having this conversation.
Right, exactly.
And probably more first responders would be in Princeton House than we currently have. So it's not something that, you know, one of the characteristics of alcoholism and many of the disorders is denial. You know, I often chuckle at the acronym, which is Don't Even Know I'm Lying, for denial.
Uh-huh.
You know, when I first heard that, it was like, that really sends a very powerful message.
Right,
because
right.
there's an element of truth in that. I don't have a drinking problem. When you're drinking alcohol at 8 o'clock in the morning instead of orange juice or tomato juice, and you think it's normal because you just got off a midnight shift, you know, someone else might see that as very unusual.
Right, right.
Especially if it becomes a pattern.
And I know that in mental health, which I'm deeply involved in, we say when we do presentations and stuff, if you suspect someone of thinking about committing suicide, don't be afraid to ask them, are you thinking of committing suicide? Are you thinking of hurting yourself? It's not going to push them over to commit suicide. It just may be the point that they need to talk.
Absolutely.
And they, you know, and I'm pretty sure that it could work similar in your situations. The cop is maybe say, no, I'm fine, I'm great, I'm
but that's
everything's
a question.
Good.
That's a question we ask.
Right.
Absolutely right off the bat.
And
are you thinking about hurting yourself?
Right. Right.
Because if you think in terms of means to commit suicide, 90% of suicides committed by law enforcement is committed with their weapon.
Of course.
So the means and access is immediate.
And like I said earlier, the veterans and the police officers have a higher rate of suicide
Absolutely.
Than any other group. So, you know, it's just astonishing to me. And, you know, and I understand it perfectly, but I also understand we have to do something about it to stop it.
And obviously, our program of putting together a peer assistance response team, which is to educate and make services uh-huh. available right within the police department, educating police officers early in their career, focusing on well-being, which is a new approach
right.
that we're starting to add, taking a more of a proactive than reactive approach,
uh-huh.
and helping officers start to identify what can you do to bring wellness into your life early in your career, how important it is to make sure that your social, your career, your spirituality, your family, and your financial life reflect some degree of stability and balance.
Right, right. I'm assuming that these services are confidential.
Absolutely.
I would think. I mean, you know, I mean, that's probably a rhetorical question, but I had to ask it.
Let me say this. In today's climate, I'm not so sure anything is really confidential. But to ensure confidentiality, clearly HIPAA protects your medical records.
Right.
With depending upon the circumstances uh-huh. that warrant your admission, more often than not, your services are confidential. Whatever you say typically stays within the walls.
Right.
Unless, of course, you're going to hurt yourself or somebody else.
And well, then
confidentiality is breached no matter
right.
where you are.
Exactly.
My experience to date has been, more often than not, an officer or first responder that is seeking treatment, there's usually a job consequence. Mm-hmm. So there is some knowledge that the officer has a problem and they're seeking help, more often than not, that's a positive when they return to work. But there are those circumstances when that particular incident, because of its visibility, becomes an issue for them when they return to work, whether they first face internal affairs charges or charges related to an incident that may have precipitated their admission.
Okay. If a family wants to be involved with the treatment, is that allowable? Or
family is encouraged to be involved in treatment from admission, and that again is up to the officer. That's up to the first responder, but we strongly encourage that participation because it's an integral part of their recovery.
Sure.
Is having their family support.
And Robin, we see that with mental health issues, you know, all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes they'll sign the paper if the families can talk to the doctor or whatever, and sometimes they won't, you know. So
education is critical, and early intervention is important.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. In anything,
often,
you know.
Far too often you have officers, you have a captured audience in the police academy, and I would venture to say far too often, or not as often enough, is there a focus on the secondary dangers associated with the work they're about to engage in, and involving their families in the kind of work and the consequence of that work that they would be dealing with.
Right, right. If the length of time of the treatment depends on the individual, or is it a set period of time, or?
Well, treatment is typically driven by the clinical need and medical necessity. We have an acute inpatient facility, so typically our length of stay, if it included detox and addiction recovery, is anywhere from 16 to 19 days. Again, it's an acute inpatient, which is comparable to being in intensive care.
Right.
And then you would transition to an outpatient. Now, the challenge that we face in this profession is, because first responders work schedules that are not normal, we face many challenges to hook them into an outpatient program.
Right.
So that they can continue treatment. Now, if they're out for an extended stay, it's easy to transition them to a partial hospital or an IOP. But if they're returning to work fairly soon, it becomes very challenging to put them into a program. So we hook them up with individual therapists. And then there's Bottles and Badges, which is our 12-step recovery groups that are located in different locations in New Jersey. Princeton actually started one 2 years ago that is open to all first responders.
Okay.
Bottles and Badges is just for law enforcement and firefighters.
Is there insurance that is taken that can help pay for this, or how is it paid for, or what's the...
Most first responders have insurance. So insurance is typically not an issue for anyone seeking treatment. And in the almost 300 first responders that we've treated, insurance has never been an issue.
Okay. Well, that's good, you know,
absolutely.
Because they need help, you know, and...
It's not been a barrier for access.
Okay. Now, you had mentioned when they return to their job, they still receive care, and et cetera. How, if they're returning to their job, how many people on their job know that they have this problem? And is it a problem for them to face these people?
Well, there's an old saying in police work, if you want to keep a secret, put it on the bulletin board. If you want to start a rumor, tell another police officer. So it's pretty fair to say that if someone's in treatment, the police officers are going to, they're police officers. They're going to find out what's going on with a fellow officer. So they'll know more often than not that someone's not here for 20 days, 30 days.
Right.
Something's not right.
Right. And how do, in most cases, do the other officers react? Just, I know it's not a...
Concern, you know, obviously, concern and compassion, because the reality is...
It could be them.
That could be them.
Yeah, exactly.
So what's interesting is you may have several different responses to that. Officers may stay away from that person because that person reminds them of their own vulnerability to the possibility that that can happen to them. And then you may have other officers that will embrace them and recognize that you took responsibility for a problem.
I had said earlier that I would give Robin a chance to give her phone numbers and everything again. So is these the same numbers that they would reach out to you? Or is it you have a separate
Actually,
set?
Actually, I have made my cell phone available to the first responder community.
All right. Why don't would you willing to give that?
I have
that?
No problem making that phone number
All right.
Available.
Why don't you put that out?
That number is my mobile number is 732-771-7165. My office number is 609-497-2697.
Okay.
If it's an emergency, my cell phone is the best way to reach me. You can actually text. I've actually have become very comfortable with texting because I had to, because many of you text.
So. Not me. I don't.
No, first responders like to text.
I barely turn on my cell phone. As I told you, I left it home. I forgot it, you know. But would you mind giving those numbers again?
Yes, my cell phone number is 732-771-7165. Again, that's my emergency cell phone. My office number is 609-497-2697. The phone number for admissions inpatient is 800-242-2550.
Okay.
And what the difference is Michael just, Dr. Pizarro just gave his specific numbers, where the calls and the numbers, the 800 number and the 888 number to Princeton House, go into a whole office of dedicated staff members that help tease out whether this is the right level of care. So as Dr. Bozzaro just said, the inpatient number is 800-242-2550, and that's where the first responder program really starts out at that level. And then our outpatient number for the five different outpatient sites is 888-437-1610. And I'd just like to mention that sometimes when people do call, they're told by the admission staff, "I am so glad you called." And here the person is feeling, "Oh my God, this is the hardest call I've ever had to make."
Right.
But on our end, we are so glad they called, because this is the beginning of the change. This is the first step.
It's the first step. And that's usually the hardest step.
Yes.
Our program is in Princeton. The inpatient program is on Herringtown Road, 905 Herringtown Road in Princeton. That's where the first responder inpatient program is located.
Okay. Well, I can't tell you how thankful I am that you came today.
Thank you.
You know, it's always a pleasure, Robin, seeing you.
You too, Liz.
You've been here before, so. But Dr. Pizarro, I really appreciate your work that you're doing, and I really mean that I'd like to have you come back down the road now that you got your feet wet with a radio program.
Thank you. It's been an honor and a privilege to communicate the importance of these issues to the general public as well as the first responder community.
Absolutely. And I agree. I think it is very, very important. And I think that they have a very good person in you leading it and directing it. And as I said, I find it very wonderful that you can speak from experience, being a police or a former police officer. You know, I think we mentioned before, I have a doctor from Long Island who deals in bipolar and depression, and she had been hospitalized prior a couple times and suffers from bipolar and depression. So when she's talking to her patients, she's talking from experience, like you're talking from experience. I also have someone who, a psychotherapist who was on recently, who deals with cutting and binge eating and so on and so forth, come to find out that she had that same problem and mastered it, but now has patients that she deals with, and they can, you know, she's talking because she's not only talking the talk, she's also walked the walk, so to speak. And I think that's awesome, because not many have, you know. And not saying that you can't be good if you haven't, but the point is, if you have, it's makes it easier to make that contact with the person, you know. You've been listening to Mental Health Matters, and again, I'm so happy that Robin Marks and Dr. Michael Pizarro came, and I will have you back again down the road. I appreciate it. You've been listening to Mental Health Matters, and